Welcome, listeners, to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, and I'm here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. This show has been running for about 7 years at this point, and every week we talk to different thought leaders, experts, advocates, scientists, authors, filmmakers, about all of the different things that affect our health and well-being and the health and well-being of our communities, our society, and the ecological stability of the Earth and all its living species. That's a pretty broad area, but there are many different facets of all of these things that impact our health and well-being, and sometimes as a society or even as individuals, we can make choices that really further and support life and health and water and all those good things. Or we can make choices that deplete, degrade, pollute, destroy those things. And so we're always making those choice points, both individually and as communities and as a society, and that's what we help inform those decisions on Connect the Dots. I'm a longstanding journalist of health, food, and the environment. That covers climate, it covers fracking, it covers public policies, and as many of you are aware, for, going on almost not quite a year, maybe about 10 months, that also has included covering the events and the aftermath of the great Water Protector uprising that occurred in 2016 at Standing Rock. And on today's show, I'm delighted to bring you more information about new and breaking developments in that regard in terms of getting environmental justice and protection for the Standing Rock tribe and all our relations. Joining me today on Revolution is the founder and executive director of a great organization called Revolution Truth. Tangerine Bolin has been a guest on this show before. She's a dear friend. She has been unwavering in her commitment to decreasing oppression, increasing liberty, and ensuring just and equitable systems. With a background in integrative medicine and health policy and a passion for truth and integrity and ways to make democracies function more optimally than they are doing right now. Tangerine and Revolution Truth have launched a lawsuit to support the human rights and the environmental justice due to specific plaintiffs, specific indigenous tribal members who were present at Standing Rock and are impacted by the government industry hand-holding decisions to put in the Dakota Access Pipeline. And so today we'll be discussing the current status of an ongoing legal campaign to water protectors and for water protections. I'm delighted to have you back with us today, Tangerine. Welcome to Connect the Dots.
Thank you so much, Allison. I'm really happy to be here today.
So tell our listeners, what the the nature of your lawsuit and how, Revolution Truth came to develop this lawsuit that is now, as Bruce Afrin, the attorney on the case, will be reporting in our next segment, having some terrific forward steps and outcomes. So tell me what the lawsuit is and how you came to launch it.
Absolutely. So last fall, as the world started to become aware of what was going on at Standing Rock in North Dakota, of course, myself and our volunteer team was observing events as well. And all of us were horrified by the rising and, rampant abuses of civil liberties and human rights that we were witnessing from afar. So that really obviously drew our interest. We're a civil liberties organization, and though we had been quiet for a while because I'm dealing with a traumatic brain injury, we all voluntarily from around the world decided to get back together and consider filing a lawsuit, and that's what we did. We worked on that for a few months. We really needed to kind of cut our teeth from afar at Standing Rock because we hadn't worked with any Native communities before, and so we really needed to be tested and to prove ourselves and prove that we were trustworthy, and I'm relieved and grateful to say that over time we did. And then what we did is we filed a case in February with a dozen plaintiffs from four different tribes, including the Standing Rock Sioux, Cheyenne River Sioux, and Oglala, And our dozen plaintiffs basically filed to what is called enjoin the Standing Rock Stew and Cheyenne River Stew lawsuit that has been going on since 2015. Why we wanted to join that case is because we had several overlapping claims, but we were coming from a very different perspective. We were filing for individual plaintiffs rather than for entire tribes, which has, you know, there are some differences under the rule of law as far as how those cases might be considered. But the judge, we didn't want to burden him with too many overlapping claims, so we asked to join their case. And just this past week, the judge, after many months of considering, did allow our plaintiffs to officially join their case and go forward with our claims.
Sorry, go ahead.
Mm-hmm. Yes, thank you. It was a big, it was a long wait. So we didn't know what was going to happen because, you know, obviously this is, you know, from our perspective as a small volunteer organization, it is a David and Goliath situation. I mean, we're volunteers from around the world, and we're tackling a $25 billion company, Energy Transfer Partners, and obviously President Trump and the Army Corps of Engineers. Those are our three defendants.
Mm-hmm.
So
well,
would you like
tell,
to
explain
just,
why President Trump has been on the lawsuit, has been the defendant named?
Yeah, so our claims are threefold. They are environmental justice and environmental racism for one, religious freedom, and administrative lawbreaking. And that one sounds kind of boring, but the administrative lawbreaking is that after President Obama various agencies had basically worked with the Army Corps and directed, you know, essentially advised them to conduct a full environmental impact statement because too many questions had remained unanswered about risk and cultural and social impact. Trump arbitrarily, just 4 days into his administration, turned around and directed this independent expert agency, the Army Corps, to abandon that EIS and go ahead and approve the pipeline. We claimed that was arbitrary and capricious, that he, as the executive, doesn't have the right to intervene in the expertise of an independent agency. Now, that was the one claim on which we didn't quite lose, but we had the judge asked us to make a distinction. He said, if you want to join the tribe's case, that particular claim is outside the scope of the overall lawsuits that you are all pursuing, so you either have to drop it or file a claim against Trump separately. We're considering which way to go. Like so many little organizations, we're resource-strapped, and so we have to pick our battles. The most important battle here is the pipeline, and that means Energy Transfer Partners and ensuring the Army Corps of Engineers does the right thing. So that's where we are
today.
So
your lawsuit does have the potential to halt the pipeline.
It does, actually. Yes, it does. Mm-hmm. And thanks to our dozen plaintiffs. I mean, these are all, you know, incredible, you know, very unique individuals who have very diverse backgrounds, but they all share some commonalities, which is that they depend on the resources in that area and or are inheritors to land, very sacred land and connected to the sacred waters of that area. And there's a profound connection to that land and water, and frankly, this pipeline poses a profound risk to both, especially the water. And the watershed, which is a partial source of water for up to 20 million people. So all of our plaintiffs have a very strong claim, and, you know, basically their voices need to be heard. They haven't been heard all along, and not only have they not been heard, Allison, these people have endured incredible civil liberties and human rights abuses from very early on with Energy Transfer Partners bringing in private groups to harass, intimidate, terrify, and abuse an already vulnerable population. And so I've just never seen anything like this. I think Standing Rock will go down in history as the single greatest concentrated abuse of human rights and civil liberties of any population in this country in one instance.
Joining us now will be Bruce Affron, who is the legal representative for the plaintiffs in this case. He is of counsel to the Mayer Law Group and a 1985 graduate of Brooklyn Law School, also holding a degree in history from the State University of New York at Binghamton. And since 1986, he's been one of New Jersey's leading civil rights and constitution lawyers, which really is places him perfectly in this case. And he's here with us now on Connect the Dots to discuss some of the recent rulings and how we can understand and interpret them and what we're looking at going forward. Welcome to Connect the Dots, Bruce Affron.
Thank you, Allison. I'm very glad to be here.
Can you, just before we get into what's happening currently, there are other cases being, there's another case which the tribe itself launching and is part of this greater lawsuit. How does your case and the case for the plaintiffs that you represent, how is it different and how do the two work together? Or complement each other.
Mm-hmm. Well, Allison, what's happened here is really very important. Judge Boasberg has agreed to allow the Native American plaintiffs, the individuals who live on the Sioux lands or have property there, to join the existing case as plaintiffs. So the original cases were filed by the Sioux tribes and the Standing Rock Sioux and the Cheyenne River Sioux. And now Judge Boasberg has allowed the individual Native American residents of those two nations to join the case.
So now is it one case and then you'll be working together with the case for the tribes as a whole? Is that how that's going to be working or will the two cases still be differentiated?
Well, it's interesting. We're now all part of one case. We will all be arguing the same issues, but mm-hmm. the Native American practitioners of the Lakota faith and the people who live there do have some positions that differ slightly from the nations. You know, mm-hmm. for example, for them, the religion is personal. And mm-hmm. any government, such as the Sioux government, you know, may be interested in religion, but it can never speak to the impact on religious life as well as an individual can. In addition, each of these plaintiffs own land or will inherit land that will be damaged and destroyed by the impact of this pipeline if there's ever an environmental disaster. So mm-hmm. the impact of it on them is much different than the Sioux governments generally. So although we're working together, there are differences that affect the individuals. There will be some slight differences, but in general, we are all going to be working toward the same goal.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, what is that goal? For our listeners, you know, what is the overarching goal here?
Well, that goal is to get this pipeline moved from under Lake Oahe, which is the primary source of water, fishing, recreation, agricultural water, drinking water, and water for religious rites for all of the Sioux practitioners and people who live there in this region. And to get that pipeline moved from under Lake Oahe to a route that avoids the lake and the river system and does not endanger the sole source of water for these nations.
Mm-hmm. So this is really a life and death matter. Is in your realm, is that considered a human rights issue or, what are the rights of human beings, facing large corporations that, here are polluting or interfering with their water supply? I mean, are there any intrinsic human rights, in relation to large matters like this? And we have a situation where the government has not been fully protective, has not done a full environmental assessment on behalf of the people, but instead, there is this time that we live in of tremendous corporate influence upon government and overreach.
Well, Allison, it's interesting. That influence was not so great on Judge Boasberg. He declared, against a lot of expectations in the oil industry, that permit is invalid. It's no longer valid, he ruled, because the Trump administration failed to conduct an adequate review and cut short the environmental review without completing it. So, you know, we always fear corporations will take over our government. But in this case, the court was independent of any corporate influence and independent of the Trump administration. So one way we protect human rights is to do exactly what we're doing. We take this matter to court. And that's why it's so important for people such as Sarah Jumping Eagle and the other individual plaintiffs to be willing to do this. And frankly, for people to be willing to fund it. Because you can't get Judge Boasberg to rule unless the funding is there to bring a case to court. So one way we protect human rights is to go to court. Our courts are still independent, and we saw that here. But I'd say also it's a human rights issue because although there's no pollution in the lake yet, if there's a break and leak of this pipe at that site, we have guaranteed destruction of this water resource. And so Dakota Access Pipeline, by taking the shortcut, by avoiding Bismarck, by avoiding the areas of well-off white residents, and dumping this on the Native American nations, Dakota Bismarck is subjecting these people uniquely to the risk of destruction of this resource. That is a human rights violation.
Yes, it certainly is. That was their deliberate disregarding choice. And as I know from a decade of reporting on fracking, on pipelines, on climate, these pipelines inevitably corrode and break and leak. I mean, they do not withstand, this oil and these toxic substances and you know, kind of never break once in a thousand years. In fact, they regularly break. They have a very high percentage risk of, you know, corroding and leaking. So this is not a far off possibility. This is a predictable, common occurrence, and that's been studied. That's regularly known, and there's really, you know, I mean, and in fact, it's even throughout the time of the last year or so since Standing Rock uprising, numerous pipelines in that very state have leaked, have flooded, have damaged bodies of water, have damaged aquifers. This is, not a kind of over-anxious concern. This is a predictable occurrence and, a cavalier approach. So the judge's ruling has taken this back, and now where does the government stand with this? Where does Dakota Access stand with this? Like, what do they have to do now? What do you think they will do now or next, what should they be doing at this point?
Well, I think about 10 days ago, oil began flowing through the pipeline, and it began flowing just before the judge issued his ruling. He didn't see a basis to stop it earlier on an injunction, but in looking at the facts, he agreed that the permit is invalid. Sometimes when something's been in operation already, even if the permit's invalid, the court might not stop its operation. That's going to be the next issue for the court to consider, whether to put an injunction on the flow of oil under Lake Oahe until the Army Corps completes a proper environmental assessment. We're going to argue that we need to do that because unless that's done, we don't know what the risk of breakage really means. And we're in a situation where we know, as you just very eloquently said, these pipelines break. These pipelines leak. They separate. They corrode. Already there were two leaks on the Dakota Access Pipeline. Fortunately, they were small, and the system corrected it quickly. But a leak could not easily be detected under the lake, can't be easily reached necessarily, even on the exit or entrance points to the lake. And we could face a situation where within a short period of time, a vital drinking resource is destroyed. So we're going to go to court and argue the judge needs to enjoin this, at least under Lake Oahe, until the Army does its environmental review. I don't know what the judge will say, but certainly Dakota Access Pipeline took the risk of starting the flow of oil knowing the plaintiffs were contesting the legality of the Army Corps' permit. And Dakota Access chose to go into business with this pipeline and send oil through knowing this issue was still before the court. So they took the risk. But I don't think there should be too much judicial sympathy for them. And we're going to ask the court to enjoin continued flow of oil. We'll see what happens.
Yeah, that sounds, you know, that should occur in a very timely way, because this pipeline could, you know, begin to leak and damage this water supply at almost any point. Let me ask you, another question. The lawsuit has been known as Jumping Eagle versus Trump. This is because of the participation of Sarah Jumping Eagle, who was at Standing Rock and will be joining us shortly on the show here. But I understand that the judge has requested that the versus Trump part, the direction, the designation of the president who made the decision to cut short the review and proceed with this pipeline, as the defendant in the case, that he's asked for an alteration of that. Can you explain that, you know, what's going on there a bit for our listeners?
Yeah, Allison, we really, wanted President Trump to be in the case because it's his foolish jumping the gun that led to this problem. You know, the Obama administration in its last weeks made a very thorough study as to why the environmental review is defective. And whether one agrees or disagrees, it was a very thorough presentation. And President Trump comes into office and simply says, I've looked at he directs the Army to expedite its environmental review, and the Army, following the president's order, says, we've looked at the original record from last July. We think that was fine, and there's no need to go further. And the Army makes that finding with seven pages in which it lists every document that was in the record, and then in a single paragraph says, all of this was sufficient. We don't need to have further review. Well, anyone looking at that realizes that President Trump forced them to cut short their review, and they offered no justification for why the Obama administration's detailed analysis was wrong. So we sued President Trump because we thought he intervened illegally. He's not an engineer. He's not an environmental scientist. Frankly, he had no business telling the Army to expedite its review. So the judge has ruled, because that's a different issue from the original claims raised by the Sioux Nations, if we want to pursue that, that will have to be in a separate lawsuit. And so we're agreeing to litigate that later if we choose to. That might mean losing the wonderful name Jumping Eagle v. Trump. But frankly, Jumping Eagle v. the Army of the United States evokes the cause just as well.
Yes, it certainly does. And, you know, through your analysis of the environmental review that was done, where are the places, or why is it that it, I mean, obviously it was, cut short, it was not complete, but, do you know any specifics of what aborting the review did in terms of things that the review failed to successfully evaluate?
Well, sure. In fact, the Obama administration made this very clear. There was no environmental impact statement. There was no study along the lines of a traditional environmental impact statement, which is a very detailed analysis of a whole multiplicity of factors, not only in terms of water quality, but impacts on water life, animal life, adjoining land areas, impacts on cultural practices, impacts on religious practices. All of this is imbued within an environmental impact statement. And also the question of environmental discrimination was ignored by the Army. Dakota Access had originally planned to run this past Bismarck, and that was moved and turned onto the Sioux Nations region. And we know why it was moved. It's a typical case of what we call environmental discrimination or environmental racism, where a company says, well, we don't want to go after this relatively well-off population here. Let's dump it on the Indian population, which is poorer and is not going to have the resources to fight us. And this is exactly how very dangerous facilities end up in parts of cities that have minority populations, in parts of the country with poor rural populations, or in this case, poor Native American populations. None of these issues were looked at. And the Obama administration very properly said, we have not had a proper study on any environmental impact.
So, so that all remains to be done. I mean, if they are then enjoined from continuing to flow the oil through the pipeline, as they had rushed ahead to do, knowing that this matter was on the table, then they could be looked, they could be, hopefully they will be, stopped from continuing with that before an assessment can be done. Typically, how long would such an assessment take? You know, what kind of delay would this, if the judge ruling goes in the right direction, would it take for them to go back to the drawing board and recommence their evaluation?
Well, Allison, a Trump assessment takes about an hour and a half. A proper assessment takes about 6 months or even up to a year. There's a vast array of factors one has to look at, none of which was done here. So, this is an extensive project, and Dakota Access has only itself to blame. Had it not interfered in the process, had it encouraged a proper environmental impact review, had it not sought to dump this project on Native American people out of fear that the white residents of Bismarck would go to court, it would be in business already without any issues. And so it created its own problems. It also deliberately ran this pipeline in a most sensitive ecological area under the only source of drinking water for these Native American nations. To subject the Sioux nations to the risk that their only source of drinking and agricultural water can ultimately be tainted and destroyed by a pipeline break is utterly irresponsible. Dakota Access has only itself to blame for choosing this route. And it now has to go through the many months of a thorough environmental study that was not done by the Trump administration.
Yeah, this is really a turnaround moment where, the Native and Indigenous peoples of this very land, are getting the due attention for years and years of disenfranchisement and neglect, failure to honor treaties and all the rest of it. And, of course, when they began this, they just thought this will just be one more, bar in the long litany of injustices that have been done to Native people, and they were not really expecting the amazing popular, the Native uprising joined by the uprising of people flooding in to act as allies and water protectors from all around, the country and the world. They were thinking they're just going to pull another fast one. And they, continue to very brazenly insist upon it because obviously it would cost some money to redirect their efforts. And they trust in the various forces of collusion that they can just ram this through in full public view. But it's not going according to their game plan, thankfully, because of your work. Our next and final guest on today's Connect the Dots is someone I'm really honored to have joining us today. She is Sarah Jumping Eagle. She is an MD, a pediatrician, in fact. She is a member of the Oglala Lakota Nation, as well as resides in the Standing Rock area. And she is one of the lead plaintiffs in the case. The lawsuit that we've been discussing has been called Jumping Eagle versus Trump, although, as we have learned from recent developments, that it may not proceed under that name in terms of what's going on next and right now. And I also have been so aware of Sarah Jumping Eagle's tremendous leadership for her people because of her visit a month or two back to Norway with a group of women water protectresses who traveled to Norway to encourage that country, which is heavily invested in fossil fuel energy, to divest from the Dakota Access Pipeline, which, in fact, they had some considerable success in telling their story. And so happy to welcome you to Connect the Dots today, Sarah, to tell your story.
Thank you. I'm Beth Duarte. I'm thankful to be on with you today.
Oh, thank you. So, you know, as Tangerine and Bruce have been describing throughout this program, there's tremendous both human rights violations with the clearing of the land and the whole siting of this pipeline, as well as abusive behaviors, egregious behaviors. Can you share with our listeners why the, you know, construction and the prospect of the Standing Rock, the Dakota Access Pipeline and the building under Lake Oahe is so damaging to you as an individual, to the other plaintiffs, and to the other tribal peoples there?
The, you know, as you previously talked about the lack of consultation and consent for the Lakota Nations in this process, for an oil pipeline that is has been constructed just north of the Standing Rock Reservation, but is in fact within the treaty territories, the 1858 treaty with the entire Lakota, Dakota Nations, which includes seven bands. This oil pipeline is built directly under the Missouri River and threatens the environmental health of the Standing Rock communities and everyone downstream from there, which also includes many other Lakota Nations, including the Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe. And other, I don't think a lot of people are aware, there's actually a water pipeline that feeds off the Missouri River and also distributes drinking water to the Pine Ridge Reservation and Rosebud Reservations as well. And not to, and that also includes those who depend on the water, who are non-native, many farmers, ranchers in the area. And it's ironic that right now in North Dakota, farmers and ranchers are suffering with a drought right now. And we know that the Bakken area, which is northwest of us, has been heavily involved in fracking, and the oil and pipeline industry depends on this water also to keep the pipelines flowing and to keep the fracking going. So we've been questioning the environmental hazards to our communities for quite some time. The state of North Dakota, the Army Corps, have violated our rights to clean water and to the assurance of the public health. You know, there's no guarantee that the glass of water that I'm giving to my daughter is not free from benzene or other chemicals used in fracking and oil industry. If and when this pipeline breaks, which we know that the Dakota Access Pipeline has already leaked in South Dakota before even going into full use. So it's just a matter of time. This is the longest pipeline that's gone underwater, under a river in the United States. And many of the, you know, what they say are safety monitors have not worked in the past. They plan to electronically monitor the pipeline pressure from Texas, I believe. And most of the pipeline leaks that have already occurred in North Dakota, the way that they were found were simply by farmers or people passing by finding oil leaking onto the land or into water. The state of North Dakota has already scaled back some of their protective measures regarding the fracking and oil industry. Companies that have already violated our environmental health protections will be fined, but then when they reach the state committees, those fines are routinely reduced to, say, $15,000. I mean, these are for huge corporations like Energy Transfer Partners. It's nothing. So this was all a part of their plan to go through and violate our cultural and sacred sites or historical sites, because for them it's more profitable to build it and then pay the fines later. The federal government has also abdicated their responsibilities to our public health. For communities that depend directly on the Missouri River for water, when this pipeline leaks, there is no guarantee that we would still be able to live in this area when so many people depend on this water for drinking water.
That is just, I'm very familiar, as are the listeners, to Connect the Dots, because I was the first news cycle reporter to cover fracking and the fractivist movement in the Northeast, as well as pipelines, as well as the Spectra gas pipeline through the nuclear power plant in New York State. And just like what you were describing, that is monitored electronically from Texas. And in fact, I have interviewed safety experts, and, you know, it's a joke because there, you know, it could take hours, if not days, for there to be a response. These heavily corrosive and poisonous hazardous substances will, you know, naturally corrode the concrete pipes. This happens routinely. It happens all the time. They can't be rendered safe. And what's really egregious here is that in addition to, it's basically violating treaty rights, and that people have to vacate the last traditional lands that they, you know, have long held or, you know, been allowed to hold when other lands were given up through treaties. And also, this spreads out like a broad network affecting many downstream communities. And I think, you know, Americans have been taught to think of ourselves as individuals. You know, I can go out and get a water filter or something. That's something that people used to say when fracking was coming to our region. Well, if it's poisoning the aquifer, can't we just get a water filter? You know, so we've been, in terms of what our notions of public health and public rights are and rights of the commons, we've been reduced to trying to fight these battles one by one. And, you know, I really salute the indigenous peoples who understand that they are fighting both for yourselves and also for everybody. And that's why support for this has been coming from so many people from so many places, because it's representative of a universal fight, you know, kind of fight of whether we're going to choose life, you know, and choose to protect life. So, you know, thank you so much for this, you know, this incredible work. I mean, so basically there are two lawsuits, as Bruce has discussed, with one, the traditional treaty rights of all the tribes are being sought to be protected. And for other, you know, for this lawsuit, this component of the lawsuit, it's you as individuals. Was there any attempt to speak to the tribal peoples, to look at the environmental impacts when they made this decision? Did they make any attempt? And if so, where did that attempt fall short, that they just want to pull through and do these things without looking at what's going to happen?
From what I know, and, you know, one of the women who was on the delegation was actually the former tribal historic preservation officer, and she's well aware of the rights of the tribe to the lands, to the laws such as the National Historic Preservation Act, our Freedom of Religion Act. And so the only way that the tribe had heard about this was just randomly came across the fact that the company was hiring surveyors. And so they actually had reached out at one point to ask about this project. But by then, the company had already worked with the state to develop this, the whole plan for the pipeline project. They had already planned to build it in the place that they built it without consulting the tribes beforehand. Once they did reach out, the company came and made a presentation, but basically said where they were building it. So by then, these plans had already been made. That, I mean, we weren't aware that the original plan was to build it north of Bismarck, a largely non-native city, and they had already moved the plans to just north of our communities. So they're saying that they sent, the Army Corps saying that they sent emails.
So they're making a claim that they reached out, but they never, you know, if that email was sent to a wrong address or it went astray, then, you know, and they didn't hear back, they kind of just shrugged their shoulders and said, well, we sent an email that gives you due notice for this massive project that could result in many people having to lose their homes and vacate that area. I mean, is that what
correct
on there?
Correct. That's their argument, that they've sent emails, but that does not replace consultation and consent. The UN Indigenous Rights talks about consent, which is different than consultation. So the United States will say that in any of their attempts at communication, then they'll just check off that they consulted. These, you know, are nations that have our sovereign rights to the lands and to the water. So, I mean, it's just ridiculous the extent. And like I said, by the time they didn't initially reach out, it was actually the tribe that reached out to ask about this project. So it was a joke, really, what the U.S. Army Corps' argument is. And the fact that, you know, we know at one point in December, the United States government said that the Army Corps needed to do the full environmental impact statement. And then once Trump got in there, he did an executive order that pushed it through. And we knew that was going to happen. So it was, you know, a brief. Yes, exactly. So, and that's actually the most recent judge stating again that an EIS needs to be completed, which is what they should have done from the get-go. They didn't consider the indigenous communities living in this area. They did not even consider that these are sacred sites. This is a place. The Sacred Stone River, the Kennebaw River, is a unique place that forms sacred stones where the Kennebaw River and the Missouri River meet. These are stones that have been used for generations in ceremonies and prayers. And this is a specific site that really should have long ago been a historic site. The Kennebaw Ranch is a historic site. So even for North Dakota to disregard their own history and violate these sites is another factor that comes into play. There's so many conflicts of interest with these corporations funding the North Dakota Historic Society, who then sends their archaeologists to look at our sacred sites and say that, no, these are not prayer sites, these are teepee circles. I mean, these are the kinds of things that happen to disregard our ability to pray at these places. Now, since they've, you know, raided the camps and used military force to make people leave, they have a fence that's saying, you know, this is United States property, when really that's our treaty territory and our sacred site. So if someone tries to go pray at this site, then they would likely be charged with trespassing. And so
they have, in fact, acquired what was your traditional treaty land. They have usurped it. They have invaded it, in fact. If we did this to a foreign country, or if a foreign country came over to our country and did this, it's like, you know, this is not how we negotiate. This is not how we function diplomatically. This is not how we respect treaties or contracts or other things, is by, you know, the United States invading treaty land and disrespecting the original peoples of this land. I mean, this is, you
well,
know, if someone did this to us, everybody would be very offended. We're offended now, you know, some people are offended because people with, you know, approved visas and coming here to work, study, and contribute to this society from a foreign country have come in with all legal rights to do so. People are offended. And here we are, the U.S. government is, in fact, invading land to which it is not entitled. I just want to also ask you, Sarah, since you are a doctor and pediatrician, and it's kind of something that we assume but don't really want to think about, and I'm a longstanding reporter on health and public health myself, and came to environmental reporting when I saw what we were doing to our individual health efforts by what the choices we make as a society. What are the public health ramifications of this level of pollution to a source of drinking water for so many different peoples there and downstream? Like, what kinds of health impacts will, you know, would be anticipated if this continues and as expected leaks?
Well, we know that chemicals such as benzene and other hydrocarbons that are used to make the oil flow easier through the pipelines, and there's so many chemicals, and of course, the United States has been successful in allowing corporations to not disclose what they're using in these pipelines or in fracking fluids. So, but we do know that hydrocarbons are known carcinogens. We don't know for sure what would the impact be for exposing large groups of populations to long-term small amounts of hydrocarbons over a 20-year period. So I've said before that this is the largest public health experiment that the United States is conducting on our own people. These are the reasons that, for example, New York chose not to allow fracking in their communities because they cannot say that it's safe. So we have it backwards here where we're allowing it to happen with unknown consequences. We know that it would likely increase cancer risks. We know that some chemicals associated with fracking affect the endocrine system, our reproductive system. How is that going to affect the next generations and their abilities to have children that are healthy? Mm-hmm. We don't know. So instead of protecting the communities from these hazards, we're allowing corporations to contaminate our water and lands to the detriment of our communities. The other factor is that, you know, this company chose this site for a specific reason. These are communities that have high poverty rates, already the highest mortality rates in the nation and in this hemisphere probably, so that they banked on our voices not being heard and that we were basically, you know, throwaway people that could be allowed to suffer these risks. And we've used the term environmental genocide to describe this because when a spill happens and we're not able to use this water, we will be in a position that is similar to places in Canada where Indigenous communities do not have access to clean water. So already communities that are suffering cycles of poverty would be forced to buy water. So that's where environmental genocide comes into play, where we would not be able to either live here because of those risks and those costs to our communities.
That's huge. It's like a huge displacement that, in fact, renders people, you know, into migrants and and refugees. When we began the fracking, you know, the fractivist anti-fracking fight in New York, we looked over to Pennsylvania, where this had gone on. And again, it's in poor rural white regions, you know, of the country, low-income areas of all different kinds of people, and you know, some of the very people who ignorantly, you know, voted in the president, hoping for some change in their economic state and well-being. But when we saw this in Pennsylvania, you know, people were having to have huge water buffaloes installed at their homes, and there was no one to pick up the cost because the companies, you know, they don't take responsibility. And, I mean, this could actually force a potential migration. And where are people supposed to go if something like that were to happen? So this is not a, you know, from everything you've said, this is not well planned. It's, it's kind of corporate collusion with impunity in that, you know, they're not expecting to be held accountable. So it's really laudable that people have come together and, you know, undertaken this lawsuit. And as well as, you know, the entire water protector gathering, where the eyes of the world are now upon, you know, America and now its court system to see, you know, if our talk about being, you know, a major proponent of democracy is really carried out, you know, is really still functioning in our institutions. And thankfully for the court so far, you know, as Bruce has described, it's looking pretty good. One of the things that I want to say again is that listeners can go to Revolution Truth on the internet and can contribute to this ongoing lawsuit, because there are many forward stages to it in terms of, you know, carrying the point home. Do you feel that there is an opportunity here to actually stop this pipeline, you know, through these actions in the legal system?
I do believe so. I mean, we've seen in other situations where judges have been successful in doing what's right, despite executive orders and despite, you know, the inaction of Congress to do what's right. So I really do believe there is an opportunity for the court, the judicial system, to set a precedent of doing what's right for our communities and following the law, which is what their job is. So it is a unique opportunity, and it's powerful. And I do believe that, you know, what happened at Standing Rock is important for people to realize that state and federal governments are using police forces as corporate military against our own communities in the United States, the land of the free, quote unquote. It is scary to think that if you're trying to protect your family and your community, that you would have your civil rights and your human rights violated by your own government repeatedly. And I'm sure you discussed the ways that, you know, when, as I myself was arrested for standing up and trying to protect the community, we know that, you know, 800 other people were also arrested, and many more people had their rights violated by the state, county, and federal agencies. So we saw profiling, we saw use of social media to profile people, we saw police taking pictures of our license plates, we saw human beings put in large dog kennels and made to strip search in front of other people of the opposite sex. I mean, all of these things took place during this time at Standing Rock. And that's not to mention the use of so-called less than lethal force, which caused numerous injuries to water protectors. We know of two people that lost vision, young lady Sophia Wolanski, who has had to undergo, almost lost her arm and has undergone several surgeries. So, you know, people are being targeted. And this is not to you know, we also have to remember that these companies also have their own private security forces that have been used in places of war to protect the oil and fracking industry. So there are so many conflicts of interest. We have to realize what's happening in our country and make sure that our voices are heard and to continue to fight on all fronts, whether it's direct action, whether it's through the court system, whether it's holding corporations and our government accountable and continuing to stand up despite all these fear tactics.
Yeah, that's this, you know, this is demeaning, degrading, abusive, and life-endangering behavior. Everything that you described previously on the show, I hosted Myron Dewey and James Spione, two out of the three directors who made the film Awake, A Dream of Standing Rock. It's still circulating. For any listeners, you can go to the Connect the Dots archives at connectthedots.podbean.com and listen to that show as well as see the film Awake, A Dream from Standing Rock, which really kind of lays out. And so, you know, we have to push back on government. People can do it by participating in keeping this particular lawsuit going by going to revolutiontruth.org. And also, you know, we can work on divestment, you know, as you have done, Sarah, you know, to persuade the various banks to withdraw their money from this pipeline. There are also legal activities going on behalf of the people who were arrested. And I think the Lakota Law Project is another place where people can help. Any other suggestions for where our listeners can support, you know, the right thing being done in this, you know, for Standing Rock and all of this, for, you know, Sarah
there's also the Freshet Collective is also helping with legal fees for water protectors. And then there's another site called Mazeska Talks. It's the Lakota word for money talks. And that they've been pushing the divestment. So you'll come across a list of all the banks and organizations that are funding these companies who then fund these projects. And it's interesting how much, you know, in the divestment campaign, we've experienced the banks who will definitely try to distance themselves from these human and civil rights violations. But it's really the powerful nature of these divestment campaigns is that we're directly talking to people and telling them what we experienced and what people's money and funds are being used for in violating our rights. And so it definitely, I think, shakes people awake to realize that they can't distance themselves from the wrongdoing that's been happening.
Mm-hmm. People to people, you know, it's not just a big abstract that we can't deal with anymore. It affects multiple communities, and it affects the future of the Earth's climate. I mean, you know, that's its ability to sustain and protect human beings. This has gone on for millennia. That can be, you know, that is being undermined by these very same fossil fuel extraction and utilization addictions that we have. I want to thank you so much, Sarah Jumping Eagle and Tangerine Bolin of Revolution Truth, for being on the Connect the Dots with me and our listeners today. Thank you for your work. Oh, we're having an animal also chiming in there. Yeah, thank you too.
thank you.
It's been a pleasure and an honor to work with Sarah Jumping Eagle and the rest of our plaintiffs and our amazing legal team. You know, and thank you to the public that is supporting this, because we depend entirely on crowdsourcing the funding to make sure that these lawsuits can happen. So any donation, large or small, is will take us the distance and help us defeat this $25 billion company and its egregious abuses and hold them accountable. So
yeah, that's great. It's really, yeah, that's really terrific, and it's happening. So anyone who's invested earlier in this can invest again because it's moving forward and it's productive. So thank you so much, both of you, and thanks also to the Animal Companion, and thanks to you listeners for being with us today on this edition of Connect the Dots. Please like our show on iTunes, share it with friends so that more people can be informed and involved and supportive of this terrific effort. We'll be here back with you again next Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm Allison Rose Levy. Chin up, keep marching forward, and standing tall with all our relations.
Well.